Random House Audio presents T is for Trespass by Sue Grafton. Read for you by Judy Kay. T is for Trespass. Prologue. I don't want to think about the predators in this world. I know they exist, but I prefer to focus on the best in human nature, compassion, generosity, a willingness to come to the aid of those in need. The sentiment may seem absurd, given our daily ration of news stories detailing thievery, assault, rape, murder, and other treacheries. To the cynics among us, I must sound like an idiot, but I do hold to the good, working wherever possible to separate the wicked from that which profits them. I know there will always be someone poised to take advantage of the vulnerable, the very young, the very old, and the innocent of any age. I know this from long experience. Solana Rojas was one. Chapter 1. Solana. She had a real name, of course, the one she'd been given at birth and had used for much of her life. But now she had a new name. She was Solana Rojas, whose personhood she'd usurped. Gone was her former self, eradicated in the wake of her new identity. This was as easy as breathing for her. She was the youngest of 9 children. Her mother, Marie Therese, had borne her first child, a son, when she was 17, and a second son when she was 19. Both were the product of a relationship never sanctified by marriage, and while the two boys had taken their father's name, they'd never known him. He'd been sent to prison on a drug charge, and he'd died there, killed by another inmate in a dispute over a pack of cigarettes. At the age of 21, Marie Therese had married a man named Panos Aguilar. She'd borne him 6 children in a period of 8 years before he left her and ran off with someone else. At the age of 30, she found herself alone and broke, with 8 children ranging in age from 13 to 3 months. She'd married again, this time to a hard-working, responsible man in his 50s. He fathered Solana, his first child, her mother's last, and their only offspring. During the years when Solana was growing up, her siblings had laid claim to all the obvious family roles, the athlete, the soldier, the cut-up, the achiever, the drama queen, the hustler, the saint, and the jack of all trades. What fell to her lot was to play the ne'er-do-well. Like her mother, she'd gotten pregnant out of wedlock and had given birth to a son when she was barely 18. From that time forward, her progress through life had been hapless. Nothing had ever gone right for her. She lived paycheck to paycheck, with nothing set aside and no way to get ahead. Or so her siblings assumed. Her sisters counseled and advised her, lectured and cajoled, and finally threw up their hands, knowing she was never going to change. Her brothers expressed exasperation, but usually came up with money to bail her out of a jam. None of them understood how wily she was. She was a chameleon. Playing the loser was her disguise. She was not like them, not like anyone else. But it had taken her years to fully appreciate her differences. At first, she thought her oddity was a function of the family dynamic. But early in elementary school, the truth dawned on her. The emotional connections that bound others to one another were absent in her. She operated as a creature apart, without empathy. She pretended to be like the little girls and boys in her grade, with their bickering and tears, their tattling, their giggles, and their efforts to excel. She observed their behavior and imitated them, blending into their world until she seemed much the same. She chimed in on conversations, but only to feign amusement at a joke or to echo what had already been said. She didn't disagree. She didn't offer an opinion because she had none. She expressed no wishes or wants of her own. She was largely unseen, a mirage or a ghost, watching for little ways to take advantage of them. While her classmates were self-absorbed and oblivious, she was hyper-aware. She saw everything and cared for nothing. By the age of 10, she knew it was only a matter of time before she found a use for her talent for camouflage. By the age of 20, her disappearing act was so quick and so automatic that she was often unaware she'd absented herself from the room. One second, she was there. The next, she was gone. She was a perfect companion because she mirrored the person she was with, becoming whatever they were. She was a mime and a mimic. Naturally, people liked and trusted her. She was also the ideal employee, responsible, uncomplaining, tireless, willing to do whatever was asked of her. She came to work early. She stayed late. This made her appear selfless, when, in fact, she was utterly indifferent, except when it was a matter of furthering her own aims. In some ways, the subterfuge had been forced on her. Most of her siblings had managed to put themselves through school, and at this stage of their lives, they appeared more successful than she. It made them feel good to help their baby sister, whose prospects were pathetic compared with their own. While she was happy to accept their largesse, she didn't like being subordinate to them. She'd found a way to make herself their equal, having acquired quite a bit of money that she kept in a secret bank account. It was better that they didn't know how much her lot in life had improved. Her next older brother, the one with the law degree, was the only sibling she had any use for. He didn't want to work any harder than she did, and he didn't mind bending the rules if the payoff was worthwhile. She'd borrowed an identity, becoming someone else on two previous occasions. She thought fondly of her other personas, as one would of old friends who'd moved to another state. Like a method actor, she had a new part to play. She was now Solana Rojas, and that's where her focus lay. She kept her new identity wrapped around her like a cloak, feeling safe and protected in the person she'd become. The original Solana, the one whose life she'd borrowed, was a woman she'd worked with for months in the convalescent wing of a home for seniors. The real Solana, whom she now thought of as the other, was an LVN. She, too, had studied to become a licensed vocational nurse. The only difference between them was that the other was certified, while she'd had to drop out of school before she'd finished the coursework. That was her father's fault. He died, and no one had stepped forward to pay for her education. After the funeral, her mother asked her to quit school and get a job. So that was what she'd done. She'd found work first cleaning houses, and later as a nurse's aide, pretending to herself that she was a real LVN, which she would have been if she'd finished the program at City College. She knew how to do everything the other did, but she wasn't as well paid because she lacked the proper credentials. Why was that fair? She'd chosen the real Solana Rojas the same way she'd chosen the others. There was a 12-year difference in their ages, the other being 64 years old to her 52. Their features weren't really similar, but they were close enough for the average observer. She and the other were roughly the same height and weight, though she knew weight was of little consequence. Women gained and lost pounds all the time, so if someone noticed the discrepancy, it was easily explained. Hair color was another insignificant trait. Hair could be any hue or shade found in a drugstore box. She'd gone from a brunette to a blonde to a redhead on previous occasions, all of which were in stark contrast to the natural gray hair she'd had since she was 30. Over the past year, she'd darkened her hair little by little, until the match with the other was approximate. Once, a new hire at the convalescent home had mistaken the two for sisters, which had thrilled her to no end. The other was Hispanic, which she herself was not. She could pass if she chose. Her ethnic forebears were Mediterranean, Italians and Greeks with a few Turks thrown in, olive-skinned and dark-haired with large dark eyes. When she was in the company of Anglos, if she was quiet and went about her business, the assumption was that she didn't speak much English. This meant many conversations were conducted in her presence as though she couldn't understand a word. In truth, it was Spanish she couldn't speak. Her preparations for lifting the other's identity had taken an abrupt turn on Tuesday of the week before. On Monday, the other told the nursing staff she'd given 2 weeks' notice. Soon her classes were starting and she wanted a break before she devoted herself to school full time. This was the signal that it was time to put her plan into operation. She needed to lift the other's wallet, because a driver's license was crucial to her scheme. Almost as soon as she thought of it, the opportunity arose. That's what life was like for her. One possibility after another, presenting itself for her personal edification and advancement. She hadn't been given many advantages in life, and those she had, she'd been forced to create for herself. She was in the staff lounge when the other returned from a doctor's appointment. She'd been ill some time before, and while her disease was in remission, she'd had frequent checkups. She told everyone her cancer was a blessing. She was more appreciative of life. Her illness had motivated her to reorder her priorities. She'd been accepted to graduate school, where she would study for an MBA in healthcare management. The other hung her handbag in her locker and draped her sweater over it. There was only the one hook, as a second hook had a screw missing and dangled uselessly. The other closed her locker and snapped shut the combination lock without turning the dial. She did this so it would be quicker and easier to pop the lock open at the end of the day. She'd waited, and when the other had gone out to the nurse's station, she'd pulled on a pair of disposable latex gloves and had given the lock a tug. It hadn't taken any time at all to open the locker, reach into the other's bag, and remove her wallet. She'd slipped the other's driver's license from its windowed compartment and put the wallet back, reversing herself as neatly as a strip of film. She peeled off the gloves and tucked them into the pocket of her uniform. The license she placed under the Dr. Scholl's pad in the sole of her right shoe. Not that anyone would suspect. When the other noticed her license was gone, she'd assume she'd left it somewhere. It was always this way. People blamed themselves for being careless and absent-minded. It seldom occurred to them to accuse anyone else. In this case, no one would think to point a finger at her because she'd made such a point of being scrupulous in the company of others. To execute the remaining aspect of the plan, she'd waited until the other's shift was over and the administrative staff were gone for the day. All the front offices were empty. As was usual on Tuesday nights, the office doors were left unlocked so a cleaning crew could come in. While they were hard at work, it was easy to enter and find the keys to the locked file cabinets. The keys were kept in the secretary's desk and needed only to be plucked up and put to use. No one questioned her presence, and she doubted anyone would remember later that she'd come and gone. The cleaning crew was supplied by an outside agency. Their job was to vacuum, dust, and empty the trash. What did they know about the inner workings of the convalescent wing in a senior citizen's home? As far as they were concerned, given her uniform, she was a bona fide RN, a person of status and respect, entitled to do as she pleased. She removed the application the other had filled out when she applied for the job. This 2-page form contained all the data she would need to assume her new life. Date of birth. Place of birth, which was Santa Teresa. Social security number, education, the number of her nursing license, and her prior employment. She made a photocopy of the document, along with the 2 letters of recommendation attached to the other's file. She made copies of the other's job evaluations and her salary reviews, feeling a flash of fury when she saw the humiliating gap between what the two of them were paid. No sense fuming about that now. She returned the paperwork to the folder and replaced the file in the drawer, which she then locked. She put the keys in the secretary's desk drawer again and left the office. Chapter 2, December, 1987. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator in the small Southern California town of Santa Teresa, 95 miles north of Los Angeles. We were nearing the end of 1987, a year in which the Santa Teresa Police Department crime analyst logged 5 homicides, 10 bank robberies, 98 residential burglaries, 309 arrests for motor vehicle theft, and 514 for shoplifting. All of this in a population of approximately 85,102, excluding Colgate on the north side of town and Montebello to the south. It was winter in California, which meant the dark began its descent at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. By then, house lights were popping on all over town. Gas fireplaces had been switched on, and jet blue flames were curling up around the stacks of fake logs. Somewhere in town you might have caught the faint scent of real wood burning. Santa Teresa doesn't have many deciduous trees, so we aren't subjected to the sorry sight of bare branches against the gray December skies. Lawns, leaves, and shrubberies were still green. Days were gloomy, but there were splashes of color in the landscape. The salmon and magenta bougainvillea that flourished through December and into February. The Pacific Ocean was frigid, a dark, restless gray. And the beaches fronting it were deserted. The daytime temperatures had dropped into the 50s. We all wore heavy sweaters and complained about the cold. For me, business had been slow, despite the number of felonies in play. Something about the season seemed to discourage white-collar criminals. Embezzlers were probably busy Christmas shopping with the money they'd liberated from their respective company tills. Bank and mortgage frauds were down, and the telemarketing scamsters were listless and uninterested. Even divorcing spouses didn't seem to be in a battling mood, sensing perhaps that hostilities could just as easily carry over into spring. I continued to do the usual paper searches at the Hall of Records, but I wasn't being called upon to do much else. However, since lawsuits are always a popular form of indoor sport, I was kept busy working as a process server, for which I was registered and bonded in Santa Teresa County. The job put a lot of miles on my car, but the work wasn't taxing and netted me sufficient money to pay my bills. The lull wouldn't last long, but there was no way I could have seen what was coming. At 8:30 that Monday morning, December 7th, I picked up my shoulder bag, my blazer, and my car keys, and headed out the door on my way to work. I'd been skipping my habitual 3-mile jog, unwilling to stir myself to exercise in the pre-dawn dark. Given the coziness of my bed, I didn't even feel guilty. As I passed through the gate, the comforting squeak of the hinges was undercut by a brief wail. At first I thought, cat, dog, baby, TV. None of the possibilities quite captured the cry. I paused, listening. But all I heard were ordinary traffic noises. I moved on, and I'd just reached my car when I heard the wailing again. I reversed my steps, pushed through the gate, and headed for the backyard. I just rounded the corner when my landlord appeared. Henry's 87 years old and owns the house to which my studio apartment is attached. His consternation was clear. What was that? Beats me. I heard it just now as I was going out the gate. We stood there, our ears attuned to the usual sounds of mourning in the neighborhood. For one full minute, there was nothing. And then it started up again. I tilted my head like a pup, pricking my ears as I tried to pinpoint the origin, which I knew was close by. Gus? I asked.
Possibly. Hang on a sec. I have a key to his place.
While Henry returned to the kitchen in search of the key, I covered the few steps between his property and the house next door where Gus Vronsky lived. Like Henry, Gus was in his late 80s, but where Henry was sharp, Gus was abrasive. He enjoyed a well-earned reputation as the neighborhood crank, the kind of guy who called the police if he thought your TV was too loud or your grass was too long. He called animal control to report barking dogs, stray dogs, and dogs that went doo-doo in his yard. He called the city to make sure permits had been issued for minor construction projects. Fences, patios, replacement windows, roof repairs. He suspected most things you did were illegal, and he was there to set you straight. I'm not sure he cared about the rules and regulations as much as he liked kicking up a fuss. And if, in the process, he could set you against your neighbor, all the better for him. His enthusiasm for causing trouble was probably what had kept him alive for so long. I'd never had a run-in with him myself, but I'd heard plenty. Henry tolerated the man even though he'd been subjected to annoying phone calls on more than one occasion. In the 7 years I'd lived next door to Gus, I'd watched age bend him almost to the breaking point. He'd been tall once upon a time, but now he was round-shouldered and sunken-chested, his back forming a C, as though an unseen chain bound his neck to a ball that he dragged between his legs. All this flashed through my mind in the time it took Henry to return with a set of keys in hand. Together we crossed Gus's lawn and climbed the steps to his porch. Henry rapped on the glass pane in the front door.
Gus, are you okay?
This time the moaning was distinct. Henry unlocked the door and we went into the house. The last time I'd seen Gus, probably 3 weeks before, he was standing in his yard berating 2 9-year-old boys for practicing their ollies in the street outside his house. True, the skateboards were noisy, but I thought their patience and dexterity were remarkable. I also thought their energies were better spent mastering kickflips than soaping windows or knocking over trash cans, which is how boys had entertained themselves in my day. I caught sight of Gus a half a second after Henry did. The old man had fallen. He lay on his right side, his face a pasty white. He dislocated his shoulder, and the ball of his humerus bulged from the socket. Beneath his sleeveless undershirt, his clavicle protruded like a budding wing. Gus's arms were spindly, and his skin was so close to translucent I could see the veins branching up along his shoulder blades. Dark blue bruises suggested ligament or tendon damage that would doubtless take a long time to mend. I felt a hot rush of pain as though the injury were mine. On these occasions, I've shot someone dead, but that was purely self-defense and had nothing to do with my squeamishness about the stub ends of bones and other visible forms of suffering. Henry knelt beside Gus and tried to help him to his feet, but his cry was so sharp he abandoned the idea. I noticed that one of Gus's hearing aids had come loose and was lying on the floor just out of his reach. I spotted an old-fashioned black rotary phone on a table at one end of the couch. I dialed 911 and sat down, hoping the sudden white ringing in my head would subside. When the dispatcher picked up, I detailed the problem and asked for an ambulance. I gave her the address, and as soon as I hung up, I crossed the room to Henry's side. She's saying 7 to 10 minutes. Is there anything we can do for him in the meantime?
See if you can find a blanket so we can keep him warm.
Henry studied my face.
How are you doing? You don't look so good yourself.
I'm fine. Don't worry about it. I'll be right back. The layout of Gus's house was a mirror image of Henry's, so it didn't take me long to find the bedroom. The place was a mess. Bed unmade, clothes strewn everywhere. An antique chest of drawers and a tall boy were cluttered with junk. The room smelled of mildew and bulging trash bags. I loosened the bedspread from a knot of sheets and returned to the living room. Henry covered Gus with care, trying not to disturb his injuries.
When did you fall?
Gus flicked a pain-filled look at Henry. His eyes were blue, the lower lids as droopy as a bloodhound's.
Last night, I fell asleep on the couch. Midnight, I got up to turn off the television and took a tumble. I don't remember what caused me to fall. One second I was up, the next I was down.
His voice was raspy and weak. While Henry talked to him, I went into the kitchen and filled a glass with water from the tap. I made a point of blanking out my view of the room, which was worse than the other rooms I'd seen. How could someone live in such filth? I did a quick search through the kitchen drawers, but there wasn't a clean towel or dish rag to be found. Before I returned to the living room, I opened the back door and left it ajar, hoping the fresh air would dispel the sour smell that hung over everything. I handed the water glass to Henry and watched while he pulled a fresh handkerchief from his pocket. He saturated the linen with water and dabbed it on Gus's dry lips. 3 minutes later, I heard the high wailing siren of the ambulance turning onto our street. I went to the door and watched as the driver double-parked and got out with the 2 additional paramedics who had ridden in the back. A bright red fire rescue vehicle pulled up behind, spilling EMT personnel as well. The flashing red lights were oddly syncopated, a stuttering of red. I held the door open, admitting 3 young men and 2 women in blue shirts with patches on their sleeves. The first guy carried their gear, probably 10 to 15 pounds worth, including an EKG monitor, defibrillator, and pulse oximeter. One of the women toted an ALS jump bag, which I knew contained drugs and an intubation set. I took a moment to close and lock the back door, and then waited on the front porch while the paramedics went about their business. This was a job where they spent much of their time on their knees. Through the open door, I could hear the comforting murmur of questions and Gus's tremulous replies. I didn't want to be present when the time came to move him. One more of his yelps and they'd be tending to me. Henry joined me a moment later, and the two of us retreated to the street. Neighbors were scattered along the sidewalk, attentive in the wake of this undefined emergency. Henry chatted with Moza Lowenstein, who lived two houses down. Since Gus's injuries weren't life-threatening, we could talk among ourselves without any sense of disrespect. It took an additional 15 minutes before Gus was loaded into the back of the ambulance. By then, he was on an IV line. Henry consulted with the driver, a hefty, dark-haired man in his 30s, who told us they were taking Gus to the emergency room at Santa Teresa Hospital, referred to fondly by most of us as St. Terry's. Henry said he'd follow in his car.
Are you coming?
I can't. I have to go to work. Will you call me later?
Of course. I'll give you a buzz as soon as I know what's going on.
I waited until the ambulance departed, and Henry had backed out of his drive before I got in my car. On the way into town, I stopped off at an attorney's office and picked up an order to show cause notifying a non-custodial spouse that a modification of child support was being sought. The ex-husband was a Robert Vest, whom I was already fondly thinking of as Bob. Our Bob was a freelance tax consultant working from his home in Colgate. I checked my watch, and since it was only a few minutes after 10, I headed to his place in hopes of catching him at his desk. I found his house and passed at a slightly slower speed than normal, then circled back and parked on the opposite side of the street. Both the driveway and the carport were empty. I put the papers in my bag, crossed, and climbed his front steps to the porch. The morning newspaper lay on the mat, suggesting that Bobby wasn't yet up. Might have had a late night. I knocked and waited. 2 minutes passed. I knocked again, more emphatically. Still no response. I edged to my right and took a quick peep in the window. I could see past his dining room table and into the darkened kitchen beyond. The place had that glum air of emptiness. I returned to my car, made a note of the date and time of the attempt, and went on to the office. Chapter 3. Solana. 6 weeks after the other left her job, she gave notice herself. This was a graduation day of sorts. It was time to say goodbye to her work as a lowly nurse's aide and advance her career as a newly credentialed LVN. Though no one else knew it, there was now a duplicate Solana Rojas in the world, living parallel lives in the same community. Some people saw Santa Teresa as a small town, but Solana knew she could go about her business without much risk of running into her namesake. She'd done it before with surprising ease. She'd acquired 2 new credit cards in Solana Rojas' name, substituting her own street address. To her way of thinking, her use of the other's license and credit wasn't fraudulent. She wouldn't dream of charging merchandise that she didn't intend to pay for. Far from it. She took care of her bills the minute they came in. She might not cover the entire outstanding balance, but she was prompt about writing her newly printed checks and mailing them off. She couldn't afford to be in arrears, because she knew if an account was turned over to a collection agency, her duplicity might come to light. This would never do. There must be no black marks against the other's name. The only tiny snag she could see was that the other's cursive was distinct and her signature impossible to duplicate. Solana had tried, but she couldn't master the slapdash way of it. She worried that some overzealous store clerk would compare her signature to the miniature signature reproduced on the other's license. To avoid questions arising, she carried a wrist brace in her purse and strapped it around her right wrist before she shopped. This allowed her to claim carpal tunnel syndrome, which netted her sympathy instead of suspicion at her clumsy approximation of the other's signature. Even then, there'd been a close call at a department store downtown. As a treat, she was buying brand new sheets, a new spread, and 2 down pillows, which she'd taken to the counter in the linen department. The saleswoman had rung up the items, and when she glanced at the name on the credit card, she looked up with surprise. I can't believe this. I just waited on a Solana Rojas less than 10 minutes ago. Solana smiled and waved aside the coincidence. That happens all the time. There are three of us in town with the same first and last names. Everybody gets us mixed up. I can imagine, the saleswoman said. It must be irksome. It's really no big deal, though it's comical sometimes. The saleswoman glanced at the credit card, her tone of voice pleasant. May I see some ID? Absolutely, Solana said. She opened her handbag and made a show of rooting through the contents. She realized in a flash that she didn't dare show the woman the stolen driver's license when the other had just been there. By now, the other would have a duplicate license in her possession. If she'd used it for identification purposes, the saleswoman would be looking at the same one twice. She stopped searching through the bag, her tone perplexed. Oh, for heaven's sake, my wallet's gone. I can't think where I could have left it. Did you do any other shopping before you came here? You know what? I did. I remember now I took out my wallet, and I put it on the counter when I was buying a pair of shoes. I was sure I picked it up again because I took out my credit card, but I must have left it behind. The saleswoman reached for the phone. I'll be happy to check with the shoe department. They're probably holding it. Oh, it wasn't here. It was in a store down the street. Well, no matter. Why don't you set these aside, and I'll pick them up and pay for them as soon as I have my wallet back. Not a problem. I'll have your purchases right here. Thank you. I'd appreciate it. She left the store, abandoning the bedding, which she ended up buying at a shopping mall miles from downtown. The encounter frightened her more than she cared to admit. She gave the matter a great deal of thought in the days that followed, and finally decided there was too much at stake to take chances. She went down to the Hall of Records and got a duplicate of the other's birth certificate. Then she went to the DMV and applied for a driver's license under the name Solana Rojas, using her own Colgate address. She reasoned that there was surely more than one Solana Rojas in the world, just as there was more than one John Smith. She told the clerk her husband had died and she'd just learned to drive. She had to take a written exam and go through the motions of a driving test with an officious fellow sitting next to her. But she'd passed both with ease. She'd signed the forms and had her photo taken, and in return she was given a temporary license until the permanent one could be processed in Sacramento and sent to her by mail. That done, she had another, perhaps more practical matter to address. She had money, but she didn't want to use it to support herself. She kept a secret stash in case she needed to disappear, which she knew she would at some point. But she needed a regular income. After all, she had her son, Tiny, to provide for. A job was essential. To that end, she'd been combing the classifieds day after day for weeks without luck. There were more jobs for machinists, house cleaners, and day laborers than there were for healthcare professionals, and she resented the implications. She'd worked hard to get where she was, and now it appeared that there was no demand for her services. Two families were advertising for live-in child care. One specified experience with infants and toddlers, and the other made mention of a preschool-age child. In both instances, the ad said mom was working outside the home. What kind of person opened her door to anyone who was bright enough to read? Women these days had no sense. They behaved as though mothering was beneath them, a trivial job that could be meted out to any stranger walking in off the street. Didn't it occur to them that a pedophile could check the paper in the morning and have himself ensconced with his latest victim by the end of the day? All the attention paid to references and background checks was meaningless. These women were desperate and would snap up anyone who was polite and looked halfway presentable. If Solana were willing to settle for long hours and bad pay, she'd apply for those positions herself. As it was, she'd set her sights on something better. She had Tiny to consider. The two of them had shared the same humble apartment for close to 10 years. He was the object of much discussion among her siblings, who saw him as spoiled, irresponsible, and manipulative. The boy's given name was Tommaso. In the wake of his 13-pound, 6-ounce arrival, she'd suffered an infection in her female parts, which had cured her of both the desire for other children and the ability to bear them. He was a beautiful infant, but the pediatrician who examined him at birth said he was defective. She couldn't remember the term for it now, but she'd ignored the doctor's somber words. Despite her son's size, his cry was feeble and mewing. He was listless with poor reflexes and very little muscle control. He had difficulty sucking and swallowing, which created feeding problems. The doctor told her the boy would be better off in an institution where he could be cared for by those accustomed to children like him. She was having none of it. The child needed her. He was the light and joy of her life, and if he had problems, she'd find a way to deal with them. Before he was a week old, one of her brothers had tagged him with the nickname Tiny, and he'd been known by that name since. She thought of him fondly as Tonto, which seemed fitting. Like the Tonto in old Western movies, he was her tag-along, a loyal and faithful sidekick. He was 35 years old now, with a flat nose, deep-set eyes, and a smooth baby face. He wore his dark hair pulled back in a ponytail, exposing ears set low on his head. He wasn't an easy child, but she'd devoted her life to him. By the time he was in the special education equivalent of sixth grade, he weighed 180 pounds and had a doctor's standing order excusing him from P.E. He was hyperactive and aggressive, given to temper tantrums and destructiveness when thwarted. He'd done poorly through grade school and junior high because he suffered a learning disorder that made reading difficult. More than one school counselor suggested he was mildly retarded, but Solana scoffed. If he had trouble concentrating in class, why blame him? It was the teacher's fault for not doing her job better. It was true he had a speech problem, but she had no trouble understanding him. He'd been held back twice, in fourth grade and again in the eighth, and finally dropped out in his sophomore year of high school the day he turned 18. His interests were limited, and this, coupled with his size, precluded his holding a regular job or any kind of job at all. He was strong and useful, but he really wasn't cut out for much in the way of work. She was his sole support, and that suited them both. She turned the page and checked the help wanted. She missed the ad at first glance, but something made her scan the entries again. There it was, near the top, a 10-line ad for a part-time private duty nurse for an elderly female dementia patient who needed skilled care. Dependable, reliable, own transportation, the ad read. Not a word about honest. There was an address and phone number listed. She'd see what information she could solicit before she actually went out for an interview. She liked having the opportunity to evaluate the situation in advance, so she could decide if it was worth her while. She picked up the phone and dialed the number. Chapter 4. At 10:45, I had an appointment to discuss a case that was actually my prime concern. The week before, I'd had a call from an attorney named Lowell Effinger, who was representing the defendant in a personal injury suit filed as a result of a two-car accident 7 months earlier. The previous May, on the Thursday before the Memorial Day weekend, his client, Lisa Ray, driving her white 1973 Dodge Dart, had been making a left-hand turn out of one of the City College parking lots when she was struck by an oncoming van. Lisa Ray's vehicle was badly damaged. Police and paramedics were called. Lisa suffered a bump to the head. The paramedics examined her and suggested a trip to the ER at St. Terry's. Though shaken and upset, she declined medical assistance. Apparently, she couldn't bear the idea of waiting hours just to be sent home with a set of cautions and a prescription for a mild pain reliever. They told her what to watch for in terms of a possible concussion, and advised her to see her own physician if needed. The driver of the van, Millard Fredrickson, was rattled but essentially unhurt. His wife, Gladys, sustained the bulk of the injuries, and she insisted on being taken to St. Terry's, where the findings of the ER physician indicated a concussion, severe contusions, and soft tissue injuries to her neck and lower back. An MRI revealed torn ligaments in her right leg, and subsequent x-rays showed a cracked pelvis and two cracked ribs. She was treated and referred to an orthopedist for follow-up. That same day, Lisa had notified her insurance agent, who passed on the information to the adjuster at California Fidelity Insurance, with whom, coincidentally, I'd once shared office space. On Friday, the day after the accident, the adjuster, Mary Bellflower, had contacted Lisa and taken her statement. According to the police report, Lisa was at fault, since she was responsible for making the left turn safely. Mary went out to the accident site and took photographs. She also photographed the damage to both vehicles, then told Lisa to go ahead and get estimates for the repair work. She thought the car was beyond help, but she wanted the figures for her records. 4 months later, the Fredricksons filed suit. I'd seen a copy of the complaint, which contained sufficient whereases and wherefores to scare the pants off your average citizen. Plaintiff was said to be injured in her health, strength, and activity, sustaining serious and permanent physical injury to her body, shock and emotional injuries to her person, which have caused and will continue to cause plaintiff great emotional distress and mental and physical pain and suffering, subsequently resulting in loss of consortium, and so on and so forth. Plaintiff is seeking damages including, but not limited to, past and future medical expenses, lost wages, and any and all incidental expenses and compensatory damages as permitted by law. Plaintiff's attorney, Hetty Buchwald, seemed to think $1 million, with that comforting trail of zeros, would be sufficient to soothe and assuage her client's many agonies. I'd seen Hetty a couple of times in court when I was there on other matters, and I generally came away hoping I'd never have occasion to come up against her. She was short and chunky, a woman in her late 50s with an aggressive manner and no sense of humor. I couldn't imagine what had left her with such a chip on her shoulder. She treated opposing attorneys like scum, and the poor defendant like someone who ate babies for sport. Ordinarily, CFI would have assigned one of its attorneys to defend such a suit, but Lisa Ray was convinced she'd do better with a lawyer of her own. She was adamant about not settling, and she'd asked Lowell Effinger to represent her, sensing perhaps that CFI might roll over and play dead. Police report to the contrary, Lisa Ray swore she wasn't at fault. She claimed Millard Fredrickson was speeding and that Gladys wasn't wearing her seatbelt, which was, in itself, a violation of California traffic law. The file I'd picked up from Lowell Effinger contained copies of numerous documents, defendant's request for production of documents, supplemental request for production of documents, medical records from the hospital emergency room, and reports from the various medical personnel who treated Gladys Fredrickson. There were also copies of the depositions taken from Gladys Fredrickson, her husband Millard, and the defendant, Lisa Ray. I did a quick study of the police report and leafed through the transcripts of interrogatories. I took my time over the photographs and the sketch of the site, showing the relative positions of the two vehicles before and after the collision. At issue, from my perspective, was a witness to the accident, whose comments at the time suggested he supported Lisa Ray's account of the event. I told Effinger I'd look into it and then turned around and set up the mid-morning meeting with Mary Bellflower. Before I walked through the California Fidelity insurance offices, I donned my mental and emotional blinders. I had worked here once upon a time, and my relationship with the company had not ended well. The arrangement was one whereby I was given office space in exchange for investigating arson and wrongful death claims. Mary Bellflower was a recent hire in those days, a newly married 24-year-old with a fresh, pretty face and a sharp mind. Now she had 4 years' experience under her belt, and she was a pleasure to deal with. I checked her desktop as I sat down, looking for framed photos of her husband, Peter, and any small tykes she might have given birth to in the interim. None were in evidence, and I wondered what kind of luck she'd had with her baby plans. I thought it best not to inquire, so I got on with the business at hand. "So what's the deal here?" I asked. "Is Gladys Fredrickson for real?"
"It looks that way. Aside from the obvious, cracked ribs, cracked pelvis, and torn ligaments, you're talking about soft tissue injuries, which are difficult to prove.
All this from a fender bender?"
"I'm afraid so. Low-impact collisions can be more serious than you'd think. The right front fender of the Fredrickson's van struck the left side of Lisa Ray's car with sufficient force that it spun both vehicles in a post-collision rotation. There was a second impact when Lisa's right rear fender came in contact with the van's left rear fender. I get the general idea. Right. These physicians are all doctors we've dealt with before, and there's no hint of fraudulent diagnoses or padded bills. If the police hadn't cited Lisa, we'd be a lot more inclined to dig in our heels. I'm not saying we won't fight, but she's clearly in the wrong. I sent the claim on up the line so ICPI could take a look. If the plaintiff is claim happy, her name should show up in their database. On a minor note, and we don't think it pertains to this situation, Millard Fredrickson was handicapped in an automobile accident some years ago. Talk about someone plagued by misfortune. Mary went on to say she thought Gladys would end up accepting $100,000, not including her medical expenses. A bargain from the company's perspective, as they could sidestep the threat of a jury trial with its attendant risks. I said, $1 million reduced to $100,000? That's a hefty discount. We see it all the time. The attorney tacks on a big price tag so the settlement will look like a good deal to us. Why settle at all? Maybe if you stand your ground, the woman will back off. How do you know she's not exaggerating? Possible, but not likely. She's 63 years old and overweight, which is a contributing factor. With the office visits, physical therapy, chiropractic appointments, and all the medications she's on, she's not able to work. The doctor's suggesting the disability may be permanent, which is going to add yet another headache. What kind of work does she do? I didn't see it mentioned. It's in there somewhere. She does billing for an assortment of small businesses. Doesn't sound lucrative. How much does she make? $25,000 a year, according to her. Her tax returns are privileged, but her attorney says she can produce invoices and receipts to back up her claim. And Lisa Ray says what? She saw the van approach, but she felt she had ample time to make the turn, especially since Millard Fredrickson had activated his right turn signal and slowed. Lisa started into the turn, and the next thing she knew, the van was bearing down on her. He estimated his speed at less than 10 miles an hour, but that's nothing to sniff at when a 3,200-pound vehicle is banging into you. Lisa saw what was coming, but couldn't get out of the way. Millard swears it was the other way around. He says he slammed on his brakes, but Lisa had pulled out so abruptly there was no way to avoid plowing into her. What about the witness? Have you talked to him? Well, no, that's just it. He's never turned up, and Lisa has precious little in the way of information. Old guy with white hair in a brown leather bomber jacket is as much as she recalls. The cop at the scene didn't take his name and address? Nope, nor did anyone else. He'd disappeared by the time the police arrived. We posted notices in the area, and we ran ads in the personal section of the classifieds. So far, no response. I'll meet with Lisa myself and then get back to you. Maybe she'll remember something I can use to track this guy down. Let's hope. A jury trial's a nightmare. We end up in court, and I can just about guarantee Gladys will show up in a wheelchair, wearing a collar and a nasty-looking leg brace. All she has to do is drool on herself, and that's $1 million right there. I hear you, I said. I went back to the office where I caught up with paperwork. There are two items I suppose I should mention at this point. Number one, instead of my 1974 VW sedan, I'm now driving a 1970 Ford Mustang, manual transmission, which is what I prefer. It's a two-door coupe with a front spoiler, wide track tires, and the biggest hood scoop ever placed on a production Mustang. When you own a Boss 429, you learn to talk this way. My beloved pale blue bug had been shoved nose first into a deep hole on the last case I worked. I should have bulldozed the dirt in on top and buried it right there, but the insurance company insisted that I have it hauled out so they could tell me it was totaled. No big surprise when the hood was jammed up against the shattered windshield, which was resting on or about the back seat. I'd spotted the Mustang at a used car lot and bought it the same day, picturing the perfect vehicle for surveillance work. What was I thinking? Even with the gaudy grabber blue exterior, I'd assumed the aging vehicle would fade into the landscape. Silly me. For the first 2 months, every third guy I met would stop me on the street to have a chat about the Hemi head V8 engine originally developed for use in NASCAR racing. By the time I realized how conspicuous the car was, I was in love with it myself, and I couldn't bear to trade it in. Number two, Later, when you watch my troubles begin to mount, you'll wonder why I didn't turn to Cheney Phillips, my erstwhile boyfriend who works for the Santa Teresa Police Department. Erstwhile meaning former. But I'll get into that in a bit. I did call him eventually, but by then, I was already in the soup. Chapter 5. I have my office in a little two-room bungalow with a bath and kitchenette located on a narrow side street in downtown Santa Teresa. It's in walking distance of the courthouse, but more importantly, it's cheap. My unit is the middle one of three, set in a squat row like the cottages of the Three Little Pigs. The property is perpetually for sale, which means I could be evicted if a buyer comes along. After Cheney and I broke up, I won't say I was depressed, but I really didn't feel like exerting myself. I hadn't run for weeks. Perhaps run is too kind a word, as running is properly defined as 6 miles an hour. What I do is a slow jog, which is better than a brisk walk, but not by much. I'm 37 years old, and many women I know were whining about weight gain as a side effect of aging, a phenomenon I was hoping to avoid. I had to concede that my eating habits were not what they should have been. I devour a lot of fast food, specifically McDonald's quarter pounders with cheese, while simultaneously consuming fewer than 9 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables daily. Actually, fewer than 1, unless you want to count the French fries. In the wake of Cheney's departure, I'd been driving up to the takeout window more often than was good for me. The time had now come to shake off the blues and take myself in hand. I vowed, as I did almost every morning, to start jogging again first thing the next day. Between phone calls and clerical work, I made it to the noon hour. For lunch, I had a carton of non-fat cottage cheese with a dollop of salsa so fierce it brought tears to my eyes. From the time I removed the lid until I tossed the empty container in the trash, the meal took less than 2 minutes, twice as long as it took me to consume a QP with cheese. At 1 o'clock, I got in my Mustang and drove over to the law firm of Kingman and Ives. Lonnie Kingman is my attorney, who'd also rented me office space after I'd been relieved of the position with California Fidelity Insurance that I'd enjoyed for 7 years. I won't go into the humiliating details of my being fired. Once I was out on the street, Lonnie offered me the use of an empty conference room, providing a temporary haven in which I could lick my wounds and regroup. 38 months later, I opened an office on my own. Lonnie was hiring me to serve an ex-party order of protection on a Perdido man named Vinnie Moore, whose wife had accused him of stalking, threats, and physical violence. Lonnie thought his hostility might be diffused if I delivered the restraining order instead of a uniformed deputy from the county sheriff's office. How dangerous is this guy? Not that bad unless he's drinking. Then anything can set him off. Do what you can, but if you don't like the feel of it, we'll try something else. In an odd way, he's chivalrous, or at any rate, partial to cute girls. I'm neither cute nor girlish, but I appreciate the thought. I checked the paperwork, making sure I had the correct address. In the car again, I consulted my Thomas Guide to Santa Teresa and San Luis Obispo County streets, flipping from page to page until I'd pinpointed my destination. I took surface streets to the closest freeway on-ramp and headed south on the 101. There was very little traffic, and the drive to Perdido took 19 minutes instead of the usual 26. There's no nice reason I can think of to be dragged into court. But by law, a defendant in a criminal or civil suit must be given proper notice. I delivered summonses, subpoenas, garnishments, and assorted court orders, preferably by hand, though there were other ways to get the job done, by touch and by refusal being too. The address I was looking for was on Calcutta Street in Midtown Perdido. The house was a sullen-looking green stucco with a sheet of plywood nailed across the picture window in front. In addition to breaking the window, someone, no doubt Vinnie, had kicked a big knee-high hole in the hollow core front door and then ripped it off its hinges. A series of strategically placed 2x4s had since been nailed across the frame, rendering the door impossible to use. I knocked and then bent down and peered through the hole, which allowed me to see a man approaching from the other side. He wore jeans and had thin knees. When he leaned toward the hole on his side of the door, all I could see of his face was his stubble-covered cleft chin, his mouth, and a row of crooked bottom teeth.
Yeah?
Are you Vinnie Moore? He withdrew. There was a brief silence, and then a muffled reply.
Depends on who's asking.
My name's Milhone. I have papers for you.
What kind of papers?
His tone was dull, but not belligerent. Fumes were already wafting through the ragged hole. Bourbon, cigarettes, and juicy fruit gum. It's a restraining order. You're not supposed to abuse, molest, threaten, stalk, or disturb your wife in any way.
Do what?
You have to stay away from her. You can't contact her by phone or by mail. There's a hearing next Friday, and you're required to appear.
Oh.
Could you show me some ID?
Like what?
A driver's license would suffice.
Mine's expired.
As long as it bears your name, address, and likeness, that's good enough, I said.
Okay.
There was a pause, and then he pressed his license against the hole. I recognized the cleft chin, but the rest of his face was a surprise. He was not a bad-looking guy. A bit squinty through the eyes. But I couldn't afford to be judgmental, as the photo on my driver's license makes me look like I topped the list of the FBI's 10 most wanted. I said, "You want to open the door, or should I put the papers through the hole?"
Hole, I guess. Man, I don't know what she said, but she's a lying bitch. Anyway, she drove me to it, so I'm the one should be filing papers on her.
You can tell the judge your side of it in court. Maybe he'll agree, I said. I rolled the papers into a cylinder and pushed them through the hole. I could hear paper crackle on the other side as the document was unfurled.
Hey, come on now. Dang, I never did what's wrote here. Where'd she get this? She's the one hit me, not the other way around.
Vinnie was assuming the victim role, a time-honored move for those who hope to claim the upper hand. Sorry, I can't help you, Mr. Moore, but you take care.
Yeah, you too. You sound cute.
I'm adorable. Thanks for your cooperation. In the car again, I logged the time I'd spent and the mileage on my car. I drove back into downtown Santa Teresa and parked in a lot near a notary's office. I took a few minutes to fill out the affidavit of service, then went back into the office where I signed the return and had it notarized. I borrowed the notary's fax machine and made two copies, then walked over to the courthouse. I had the documents file-stamped and left the original with the clerk. One copy I retained, and the other I'd returned to Lonnie for his files. Once in my office again, I found a call from Henry waiting on my machine. The message was brief and required no reply.
Hi, Kinsey. It's a little after one, and I just got home. The doctor popped Gus's shoulder back in, but they decided to admit him anyway, at least for tonight. No broken bones, but he's still in a lot of pain. I'll go over to his house first thing tomorrow morning and do some cleaning so it won't be so disgusting when he gets home. If you want to pitch in, great. Otherwise, no problem. Don't forget cocktails after work today. We can talk about it then.
I checked my calendar, but I knew without looking that Tuesday morning was clear. I diddled at my desk for the rest of the afternoon. At 5:10, I locked up and went home. A sleek black 1987 Cadillac was parked in my usual spot in front, so I was forced to cruise the area until I found a stretch of empty curb half a block away. I locked the Mustang and walked back. As I passed the Cadillac, I noted the license plate, which read, "I sell for you." The car had to be Charlotte Snyder's, the woman Henry dated off and on for the past 2 months. Her real estate success was the first thing he'd mentioned when he'd decided to pursue the acquaintance. I went around to the rear patio and let myself into my studio apartment. There were no messages on my home machine and no mail worth opening. I took a minute to freshen up and then crossed the patio to Henry's place to meet the latest woman in his life. Not that he'd had many. Dating was new behavior for him. The previous spring, he'd been smitten with the art director on a Caribbean cruise he took. His relationship with Maddie Halstead hadn't worked out. But Henry had bounced back, realizing in the process that female companionship, even at his age, wasn't such a terrible idea. A number of other women on the cruise had taken a shine to him, and he'd decided to contact two who were living within geographic range. The first, Isabel Hammond, was 80 years old. She was a former English teacher, still the subject of legend at Santa Teresa High School, when I attended some 20 years after she retired. She loved to dance, and she was passionate about reading. She and Henry had gone out on several occasions, but she'd quickly decided the chemistry was off. Isabel was looking for sparks, and Henry, while flinty, had failed to ignite her flame. This she told him straight out, greatly offending him. He believed men should do the wooing, and further, that courtship should proceed with courtesy and restraint. Isabel was cheerfully aggressive, and it soon became clear the two of them were ill-suited. In my opinion, the woman was a nincompoop. Now, Charlotte Snyder had entered the picture. She lived 25 miles south, just past Perdido, in the seaside community of Olvidado. At age 78, she was still active in the workplace and apparently showed no inclination to retire. Henry had invited her for drinks at his house and then for dinner at a lovely neighborhood restaurant called Emile's at the Beach. He'd asked me to join them for cocktails so I could check her out. If I didn't think Charlotte was suitable, he wanted to know. I thought the assessment was his to make, but he'd asked for my opinion, so that's what I'd be there to give. Henry's kitchen door was open, his screen on the latch, so I could hear them laughing and chatting as I approached. I picked up the scent of yeast, cinnamon, and hot sugar, and guessed, correctly as it turned out, that Henry had dealt with his pre-date nerves by baking a pan of sweet rolls. In his working days, he was a baker by trade, and as long as I've known him, his skills have never ceased to amaze. I tapped on the screen, and he let me in. He'd dressed up for his date, exchanging his usual shorts and flip-flops for loafers, tan slacks, and a short-sleeved sky-blue dress shirt that exactly matched his eyes. I gave Charlotte high marks on sight. Like Henry, she was trim, and she dressed with classic good taste. A tweed skirt, white silk blouse over which she wore a yellow crewneck sweater. Her hair was a soft reddish-brown, cut short, expensively dyed, and brushed away from her face. I could tell she'd had her eyes done, but I didn't write it off to vanity. The woman was in sales, and her personal appearance was as much an asset as her experience. She looked like someone who could walk you through an escrow without a hitch. If I'd been in the market for a house, I'd have bought one from her. She was leaning against the kitchen counter. Henry'd fixed her a vodka and tonic while he was having his usual Jack Daniels over ice. He'd opened a bottle of Chardonnay for me, and he poured me a glass as soon as Charlotte and I had been introduced. He'd set out a bowl of nuts and a tray of cheese and crackers, with clusters of grapes tucked here and there. I said, "While I'm thinking about it, Henry, I'd be happy to help you clean tomorrow if we can finish before noon." "Perfect. I've already told Charlotte about Gus." Charlotte said, "Poor old guy. How is he going to manage when he gets home?" "That's what the doctor asked. He's not going to release him unless he has help," he said. "Does he have any family left?" I asked. "Not that I've heard. Rosie might know. He talks to her every other week or so, mostly to complain about the rest of us." "I'll ask when I see her," I said. Charlotte and I went through the usual exchange of small talk, and when the subject shifted to real estate, she became more animated. "I was telling Henry how much these older homes have appreciated in recent years. Before I left the office, just out of curiosity, I checked the MLS for properties in the area, and the median price, median, mind you, was $600,000. A single-family residence like this one would probably sell for close to $8,000, especially since it has a rental attached." Henry smiled. "She says I'm sitting on a gold mine. I paid $10,500 for this place in 1945, convinced it was going to put me in the poorhouse. Henry's offered me a tour. I hope you don't mind if we take a minute for that." "Go right ahead. I'll be fine." The two left the kitchen, moving through the dining room to the living room. I could track their progress as he showed her through the place, the conversation becoming largely inaudible when they reached the bedroom he used as a den. He had two other bedrooms, one facing the street, the other facing out onto his garden in the rear. There were two full baths and a half bath off the entrance. I could tell she was being complimentary, exclaiming in a way that probably had some dollar signs attached. When they returned to the kitchen, the subject segued from real estate to housing starts and economic trends. She could talk downturns, yields on government bonds, and consumer confidence with the best of them. I was a teeny bit intimidated by her confidence, but that was my problem, not his. We finished our drinks, and Henry put the empty glasses in the sink while Charlotte excused herself and retreated to the nearest bathroom. He said, "What do you think?" "I like her. She's smart." "Good. She seems nice, and she's well-informed. Qualities I appreciate." "Me too," I said. When Charlotte returned, her lipstick had been brightened, and she had a fresh dusting of blusher on her cheeks. She gathered her handbag, and the two of us preceded Henry out the door, allowing him a moment to lock up.
"Could we take a quick look at the studio? Henry told me he designed the space, and I'd love to see what he did."
I made a face. "I should probably tidy up first. I'm a neatnik by nature, but I've been gone all day." In truth, I didn't want her casing the joint, calculating how much the studio would add to the asking price if she persuaded him to sell.
"How long have you been renting?"
7 years. I love the location, and Henry's the perfect landlord. The beach is a half block that way, and my office downtown is only 10 minutes from here.
"But if you owned your own home, think of the equity you'd have built up by now."
"I understand the advantages, but my income is up and down, and I don't want to be saddled with a mortgage. I'm happy to let Henry worry about taxes and upkeep." Charlotte gave me a look, too polite to express her skepticism at my short-sightedness. As I left them, she and Henry had taken up their conversation. She was talking about rental properties, using the equity from his place as leverage for a triplex she just listed in Olvidado, where housing wasn't so expensive. She said the units needed work, but if he made the necessary improvements and then flipped the place, he'd net a tidy profit, which he could then reinvest. I tried not to shriek in alarm, but I sincerely hoped she wasn't going to talk him into something absurd. Maybe I didn't like her quite as much as I thought. Chapter 6. Under ordinary circumstances, I'd have walked the half block to Rosie's tavern to eat supper that night. She's Hungarian and cooks accordingly, leaning heavily on sour cream, dumplings, strudels, cream soups, cheesy noodles, cabbage-related side dishes, plus your choice of beef or pork cubes cooked for hours and served with tangy horseradish sauce. I was hoping she'd know whether Gus Vronsky had relatives in the area, and if so, how to make contact. Given my newfound goal of better balanced meals and more wholesome nutrition, I decided to postpone the conversation until after I'd eaten supper. My evening meal consisted of a peanut butter and pickle sandwich on whole wheat bread with a handful of corn chips, which I'm almost certain could be considered a grain. I grant you peanut butter is nearly 100% fat, but it's still a good source of protein. Further, there was bound to be a culture somewhere that classified a bread and butter pickle as a vegetable. For dessert, I treated myself to a handful of grapes. The latter I ate while I lay on my sofa and brooded about Cheney Phillips.